In a moment, one of Britain's best-loved comedy actors, Peter Sallis, reminisces about his career and life in That Reminds Me. And then later, at 7.15, we have a special edition of Front Row, as the National Theatre's revival of Sir Tom Stoppard's play Jumpers transfers to London's West End. Mark Lawson investigates the origins and history of the play, which mixes philosophy and farce. He talks to Sir Tom Stoppard, the actress Diana Rigg, and the actor Simon Russell Beale about the joys and the pitfalls of staging Jumpers. So join Mark Lawson tonight at 7:15. But now on BBC Radio 4, That Reminds Me, this week with the last of the summer wine actor, who's also famous as the voice of Wallace in Wallace and Gromit, Peter Sallis.
First, a dip into the wartime years. The year was 1943, and we were in the thick of it, the Battle of Britain, the Battle of the Atlantic, the Blitz. There were only two men who stood between us and being overwhelmed by the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe. One was Winston Churchill, and the other was Adolf Hitler. I formed the opinion at the time that the safest place to be in the United Kingdom was the Royal Air Force Station Cranwell in Lincolnshire. I'd like you to picture this scene, if you will. An evening in Cranwell. On such a night as this, Corporal Frank Webb is playing gramophone records to the Cranwell Music Society in Hut 300. Knowing Frank, the chances are that he was playing the Third Razumovsky Quartet of Beethoven, the one with the pizzicato slow movement. Anyway, the audience is sitting there, their chins are gently resting on their chests, absorbing the music, or possibly some of them are even fast asleep. When outside the hut comes the most awful crashing, crackling, and banging. And Corporal Webb, trained as he is to act on his initiative, leans forward and turns the volume up. And the crackling and the banging stops after a few seconds, and all is peace again, except, of course, for the Razumovsky Quartet. The following morning, waves of outrage and indignation go through the camp, because, well, I'll tell you, well, two or three senior officers threatened to resign, except as there was a war on, of course, they couldn't do that. And an American on the camp said, hey, he said, what do they think they're doing? What they were doing was that a German bomber, having deposited its bombs elsewhere, was on its way back to the fatherland and, having veered off course a bit, saw this enormous encampment below it, and it let loose all the machine gun bullets that it had got in whatever it is you put machine gun bullets into. Why am I telling you this? Oh, of course. Because I was there. I was at Cranwell at the same time. I was a corporal instructor at Number One Radio School. I taught radio theory, believe it or not, and one day after one of my classes, a pupil, his name was Peter Bridge, came up to me and asked me if I'd ever done any acting. And I said, no, I was always interested in the theatre, but no, I'd never been on the stage. I'd never even been in the school play. And he said, well, I'm going to put on a production of Hay Fever by Noel Coward at the YWCA for 3 nights, and I would like you to play the leading man. Will you do it? And I thought for a second and said yes. And I did. And when I went on the stage and spoke the lines, people laughed. I wasn't fooling myself. I mean, I knew they were laughing at Noel Coward, but at least they'd heard what I'd said, and I hadn't actually knocked over any of the furniture. And that night in my bunk, I couldn't sleep. I just went through the play over and over again, and it dawned on me after a bit. I thought, I know what it is. I've got what they call the acting bug. And so I had. And after the war, well, I'll tell you about that in a minute. Those of you who have followed it so far may... well, it hasn't been very difficult, has it? May like to know what I was doing before the war. And I will tell you, in company with others of the same age group, I went to school. It was a lovely school. It was called Minchinden. It was in North London, Southgate. A lovely old Queen Anne house set in 25 acres of land, playing fields, trees, shrubs, bushes. It was great. It was a mixed school. There were 200 boys and 200 girls. And we all got along very well indeed. The staff were good, they taught us. There was the cane, but they never used it with pleasure. And altogether, I think we were having a great time. And then it came to the end of the fifth year, and of course you had to take your, what we called in those days, the matric. And I took it with the others, and I came out quite well. I'd even got a couple of distinctions. And that was when you were supposed to leave school, except that I hadn't got the faintest idea what it was I wanted to do. Well, I had a slight idea. I thought I might like to be a journalist. I thought the idea of going out and interviewing people might be quite fun. And so I spoke to my father. He was paying 4 guineas a term for me. And so, of course, he had to be consulted. I said, do you think I could stay on? Do you think I could do shorthand typing in sixth commerce and stay on for another year so that I might become a journalist? And he said, yes, that's all right with me. So I went back to school. And I started on the shorthand and typing. The trouble was that it didn't take me long to realise that I couldn't handle the shorthand at all. All those little squiggles and circles and dots and no, I was hopeless. And they'd only got one typewriter. So it didn't really make any difference. I was so happy. I thought, this is lovely here. And I began to daydream, and I thought, maybe I could stay here forever. Maybe I don't have to leave school. There are all these lovely girls. Well, they weren't all lovely, but at least they were girls. I thought, I could marry one of them. We could have a little place behind the bicycle sheds, even raise a family. And I kept this dream, of course, to myself. And it wasn't long before the headmaster asked to see me. Lovely man, his name was Mr. A.G. Gibbs. And he said, Peter, you don't seem to be doing anything. And I said, no. And he said, well, you'll have to leave. I was horrified. I went back to my father. I said, he wants me to leave. He said, uh-huh. So I said, but I still don't know what to do. Now, my father was a bank manager, and he spoke to me as thus. He said, you could always go into the bank, he said. You go in now, you retire when you are 60, you have a pension. It's not a bad life when you think of it. Well, I didn't really fancy the idea, but I did go into the bank. I went into Barclays Bank, Bloomsbury, words that I found difficult to say when answering the phone. Barclays Bloomsbury. I was the junior clerk, and as the junior clerk, I was being paid £1.10 a week. And one of the first tasks that they asked me to do was to run what they called the stamp till. This consisted of a tin box with money in it. With the money, I bought the stamps and I stuck them on the post of the bank and I posted it. And because they knew I was getting £1.10 a week, they said, look, if you make a shilling or two on the stamp till, nobody will bat an eyelid. Backs will be turned, so to speak. I found that reassuring. But as the weeks went by, it dawned on me that week after week, without fail, I was losing money. I was losing something like 3 or 4 shillings a week. Mind you, they were kind enough not to ask me to put the money back out of my own pocket, but I thought, this is awful. I mean, this is absolutely dreadful. Here I am in a bank, and I can't even run the stamp till. And then, like something out of Dickens, an unknown benefactor arrived. Well, when I say unknown, I mean I hadn't actually met him, but obviously those close to him had told him of my plight, and he decided to do something about it. And he did. And the next thing I knew, I was in the Royal Air Force. I was an airman. Mind you, I wasn't much better as an airman than I'd been as a bank clerk. But at least I was out of the bank. A lot of people have said some very harsh things about Hitler, and of course, I can see their point of view, but I must say, he certainly did me a good turn. And so, from there, as you've gathered, I went into the Air Force, and then I finally, at the end of the war, I was still alive, and I became an actor, and I did repertory, and I did West End work, and this was sort of in the 50s, and television was growing up. And one day a television director called Chloe Gibson asked me to go and see her. And she said that the BBC were going to do a dramatization of The Diary of Samuel Pepys, and she would like me to play Samuel Pepys. Anyway, of course, I said yes, and we started work. Now, in those days, of course, television was live. You didn't get a second chance. What the audience saw was what the actors were doing simultaneously. And if they got it wrong, well, tough. Anyway, we did it in Studio D in Lime Grove, a square studio with the sets set around the perimeter. And then the cameras were in the middle and they pointed into the sets. Now, it was my diary, and therefore I had to be in every scene. I had to be in the whole of every scene, because how would I know what to write about? So we devised a little ploy. I might be in one set in one side of the studio, and then the next scene might be in this part of the studio. And we devised what we called the do but scenes, only two or three lines, where somebody said, "I do but wonder what is keeping Sam." And we knew what was keeping Sam. He was running like a ferret. I also devised what I called the gay laugh. This was a sort of ha-ha-ha. This was to give them the impression that I was enjoying it. And also, I thought it might give them my version of panache. One evening, Paul Eddington and I, Paul was playing Coventry, Paul Eddington and I were in the King's Palace Gardens being entertained by the King, and we had to go from there to a church scene round the other side of the studio. We finished with the palace scene and we ran round the back of the studio, up the steps at the back of the church, through the doors, and I went, ha ha ha! And Paul hissed, "You know it's a funeral." Sometimes people have said to me, when that first script of Last of the Summer Wine landed on your doorstep, had you any idea that it was going to last for 30 years? And I always say yes. Oh yes, I knew it would last for 30 years. In fact, I say the amazing thing about it is that it's taken it so long. I'd like you to think of another scene this time. This time it's Roy Clark, the author of all the episodes of Last of the Summer Wine. In 1972, he goes to see Duncan Wood, the head of comedy at the BBC. And they talk about this series, about three old men passing the time of day in a remote backwater in Yorkshire. I suppose if you went to a head of comedy in any of the big divisions today, they would show you the lift. But Roy went away, and he came back with his three men. They were Blamire, the leader, Clegg, the philosopher, and Compo, the clown. Except that Compo was more than a clown. He was a child. Compo was Peter Pan at the age of 60. And when Compo died, Truly asks Clegg, "Do you think he's heavenly material?" And Clegg says, "Oh, certainly. To be as little children." That was him. He never lost it, did he? Bill Owen and Roy Clark, between them, fashioned the greatest single comedy performance that has ever been done on television. And I've been watching television since 1936, and I know. Bill and Compo had absolutely nothing in common, except they were the same height and they weighed the same. But Bill, through his artistry, through his skill as an actor, created this lovable comic rogue. And when he died, well, I think those of us in the programme, most of us thought, well, that's the end of Last of the Summer Wine. But Roy was on his mettle. Not that he'd ever been off it. And he wrote these three episodes. They were called Elegy for Compo. And they were the three most beautifully constructed, beautifully written, moving, and yet hysterically funny episodes of anything that I've ever seen on television. Thank you, Roy, for Last of the Summer Wine. Some people have said to me, well, what's it like doing Last of the Summer Wine? I mean, can you describe a typical day's filming? So here goes. It's going to be seen through the eyes of Frank Thornton and me, because we are in the same hotel together and we work together. And I want you to picture a typical morning, very early in the morning. We get up and we have breakfast and we get dressed and we go downstairs, and yes, there's a car waiting for us. Oh yes, we have a car. And we look up and the skies are leaden. And it is bucketing down. And anyway, we get in the car and it drives us off to our location, into the Pennines. Up, up, up we go, 2,000 feet, 3,000 feet. We get to the location, we get out, and we are going to our caravan. Yes, we do have a caravan too. And by now, we're not looking up at the clouds, we are actually in them. It is pouring down. Anyway, we get into our working clothes and we settle down and we look out of the window, and suddenly there's a knock on the door and a young man comes in and says, look, would you like some coffee and biscuits? Oh, that would be great. Oh, coffee and biscuits. What a marvellous sight. So he brings the coffee and biscuits, and we sit down and we munch and we sip, and we do the crossword and things like that. And we are the age we are. And it begins to tell. We've had breakfast, now we've had coffee and biscuits, and and we're drifting apart. And yes, we go noddy. Noddy. Oh, yeah. And I don't know how long this lasts, but all of a sudden there is another knock on the door, and the young man comes in and says, it's still raining. And we say, yes, yes, we can see it's still raining. Yeah, well, would you like some more coffee and biscuits? Oh, that would be great. Coffee and biscuits would be, thank you, that would be marvellous. So he goes away and brings some more coffee and biscuits, and we have the coffee and biscuits, and we chat amongst ourselves what was on television last night and that sort of thing. And now the time is moving on, and it's about 12 noon. And he comes in again, and he says, the director has suggested that as it is getting on, and we think we ought to have an early lunch. What a good idea. We will have an early... Yeah, rather. Thank you very much indeed. So they bring us our lunch on a tray. Yep. And it is steak and kidney pudding. Well, you know where steak and kidney pudding goes, don't you? It goes right there. And we're going, oh, we can't fight it anymore. We're going like this. Oh. And we go... And this time we crawl to our little... couchettes, bunkettes, whatever you like to call them, and we lie down. And we go deeply asleep. Really, well. There's a lot of that goes on. We sort of jump at each other, but we survive and we carry on, and goodness knows how long it goes on for. But finally, there is another knock on the door, and the young man comes in and says, it's still raining. You've woken us up to tell us that it's still raining. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Well, all right, would you like some coffee? Yes, we certainly would like some coffee and biscuits. Thank you very much. Thanks a hump. So, he brings us the coffee and biscuits, and then about 4 o'clock, the director comes in and he says, I'm terribly sorry, but this is no good. We'll just wrap for the day, go back to the hotel. So we get changed back into our civilian clothes. We get into the car. It takes us back to Huddersfield. And as we're getting near to Huddersfield, we realise that the clouds are beginning to part. And the sun is breaking through. And the sun is shining. And it's a wonderful, beautiful evening. And that is a typical day's filming in last... One or two of you here may not know the story about how Bill Owen saved my life. So for that lucky couple, here it is. The year was 1974, and we were doing our second series of Summer Wine, and we went that particular day to a place in Yorkshire. It's got a lovely river. It's called the Wharf. That's it. I knew I'd catch up with it. The Wharf, in Wharfdale. And across the river is a bridge. And the idea was that we were going to put a camera on the bridge. Now, unlike the day that I've just described, this was a beautiful August bank holiday. It was sunny, and there were a lot of people about on the riverbank. But they see a camera, and they all gather. They had no idea who we were. They had no idea what was going to happen. But there they were. And what was going to happen was that Bill and Michael Bates and I were going to get into a canoe, and we were going to paddle it along the river, and then, as they say in nautical terms, shoot the bridge and come out the other side. And that was the shot. I went to the director and I said, look, I can't swim. I want to make it quite clear that if I go in the water, I want the entire unit to come and rescue me. And if anything happens to the other two, don't expect me to do any heroics. I shall take no notice of them at all. And then I realised that he'd walked away. I mean, I don't think he'd even heard what I'd said. Anyway, we got into the canoe. Michael said that he would be in the back, or the stern, as he called it. He knew about these things, and he would be able to steer the canoe. I was in the middle of the canoe, and Bill was in what Michael called the bow. And we went off quite well. And as we came out of the other side, I began to feel the tremor. It started to wobble, and I shouted at the top of my voice, "We're going over!" And Michael said, "No, no, no, it's all right, I've got it." But of course he hadn't. And the canoe went on its side like an accommodating harlot, and we slid into the water. I went out of my depth. I went down, blah, 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 like this. And I struck out with everything that I'd got. And fortunately, my left foot hit something hard. I got the purchase, and I shot up out of the water like a cork. I grabbed a bit of land. I scrambled up the bank. I forced my way through the crowd. I went into a field, and I thought, safe, safe. Oh, and a man came up to me, and he held me by the arm, and he said, "Excuse me, pardon my mentioning it, but weren't you Samuel Pepys?" Oh, of course, I've forgotten to tell you how Bill Owen saved my life. Yes. Well, when I went into the water and was struggling, my left foot hit something hard, and what it hit was, in fact, Bill Owen's head. In 1983, the phone went, and it was my agent to say that a young man at Beaconsfield Film School would like me to go there and to record the voice of a character in an animated cartoon film that he was planning to make. So I went to Beaconsfield and I met the young man. His name was Nick Park. And I liked him immediately. He was young, yes, he was about 23. He had a certain diffidence and charm. But most of all, really, he knew exactly what he wanted. And he told me that he wanted me to do the voice of this character in this film that he was making. The character's name was Wallace, and Wallace had a dog called Gromit. It turned out later, of course, that Gromit was the brains of the family, but I didn't know that at the time. And anyway, so he explained the story to me, and he didn't have any models. They were to be made of plasticine, but they weren't actually ready yet. But he did have a storyboard, which, as you probably can guess, tells you the main incidents of the story in pictures. And we sat down, the microphone was between us, and I recorded the voice of Wallace. The actual film was going to be called A Grand Day Out. And what I found fascinating was that Nick told me how to say every line. Now, you do a radio broadcast, for instance, and the director, however much they may talk to you, they never take you through it line by line. But Nick did. And I suppose I could have been a bit offended, but I wasn't. I was charmed. I thought, this guy knows exactly what he wants, and I'm only too pleased if I can get it right, do what he wants. And so we did it, between us, in a sense. And when we'd finished it, we shook hands and I went home. In 1989, the telephone went And the voice said, "Hello, it's Nick Park. I finished it." And I thought, 6 years? What had happened was this, that he had left the Beaconsfield Film School, his term was up, so to speak, and he'd gone to some people called Aardman in Bristol, who were already making films with plasticine material, plasticine figures. And there, they helped him to finish A Grand Day Out. But also, while he was there, he made another film called Creature Comforts. Now, I don't know whether there's anybody here who has not seen Creature Comforts. If so, I beg you to beg, borrow, or steal it. It is his masterpiece. In fact, years later, I said to him, "You know, Creature Comforts was your Citizen Kane." Anyway, that was 1989. And what he'd done was to... Both of them were nominated for Oscars in the 1990 Hollywood Oscars for the animated cartoon section. Creature Comforts won the Oscar, and A Grand Day Out came second. And then in 1993, he had finished his second Wallace and Gromit film, which was called The Wrong Trousers, and that won the Oscar. The third year after that, 1996, he made another Wallace and Gromit film called A Close Shave, and that won the Oscar that year. So in the space of what was virtually 6 years, he had made three films and he'd won three Oscars. At the moment, the grapevine has it that he's working on a feature film for Wallace and Gromit, and I just hope I can be there to help. Intimations of immortality, as somebody once wrote. The other day I was walking along Piccadilly from Hyde Park Corner to Piccadilly Circus, and as I walked past Fortnum and Mason's, that lovely old clock that hangs outside struck 11. And I kept on walking, and I got to St. James's Church, Piccadilly. And as I passed the church clock struck 11. And I thought, if I go on at this rate, I'm going to live forever. Last year, I was invited to do an episode of Holby City, the BBC's hospital drama. For this, I was required to have a medical. I suppose it was to make sure that I was well enough to go to hospital. And at the end of the examination, the doctor said, "How tall are you?" And I said, 5'7½". I knew I was 5'7½" because it said so in my passport. I was 5'7½" when I was demobbed from the Royal Air Force. And he said, "Come over here." And he stood me against the wall and he dropped a bit of wood on my head and he said, "You are 5'5". So you see, I'm disappearing. Not only am I going to live forever, but you won't be able to see me. But I'll be here. So you'd better watch out. Good night.
That Reminds Me was presented by Peter Salis. The producer was Claire Jones. Next week we'll be hearing from the actor Dudley Sutton, who